Good morning. You have tuned in to The Morning Show here on 88.5 KRFY, your community radio station. I am Jack, and across from me is Jim, and we are your usual Thursday morning co-hosts on a beautiful Valentine's Day.
This is not your usual Thursday.
No, this is a very special Thursday. This is Valentine's Day. It is February the 14th, and I have a weather forecast in front of me that is turning a little white, even whiter than we thought it was going to be, I think, up until now. So that's exciting. Happy Valentine's Day, Jim.
Well, same to you. Do you have any special plans, you and Annie?
I bought some charcoal yesterday. I'm going to light up the grill.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I just had images of you wrapping a bag of charcoal and giving it to Annie. Annie, I love you so much. Here's some charcoal.
No, I have not been grilling, you know, in, I don't know, months, I suppose. But I'm going to light up the grill and cook.
Oh, what fun.
Yeah.
What fun.
Yeah, hopefully it's not heavily coming down at the time that I do that. How about you, Jim? Anything going on?
Let's see. Not much. I'm getting ready to be gone. And when I'm getting ready to be gone, that takes
my focus.
So, yeah. But yes, I'll celebrate it. We'll probably go out to dinner someplace, that sort of thing. But just to enjoy the day and to, and we have a special guest with us, a retired cardiologist, Brad Hutaw. Good morning, Brad.
Good morning.
And we're going to talk about the heart, and what a better day than today than to talk about the heart. But give us the weather, and then I'll do the DC weather, and we can talk about the snow.
So I was listening to the morning show yesterday, and I heard Susie mention the weather, and in her forecast it called for rain. Not in this forecast. The rain has gone away, and it looks like snow, slight chance of snow. And then partly sunny on Monday. High of 33 degrees today, mostly sunny, and then a slight chance of snow. Tonight, more snow coming down. Low of 28 degrees Fahrenheit.
it's an early morning.
Yeah. Tomorrow, snow. 80% chance of snow. On Friday night, a 50% chance of snow. On Saturday night, On Saturday night, a 40% chance of snow. On Sunday, a slight chance of snow. And on Sunday night, a slight chance of snow. Finally, on Monday, which is Washington's birthday, looks like it's going to be sunny. The weather is going to be in between, or the temperature is going to be in between about 34 and 28 all weekend long, dipping down to 23 on Saturday night. Wait a minute. Then a cold snap comes, and then it's a low of 11 degrees Fahrenheit on Sunday night.
Now, is there any major snow accumulation like we had 2 days ago?
Yes. It continues to come down and stay on the ground. Tonight, 4 inches possible. On Friday, about 1.5 inches total between Friday and Friday night. On Saturday, not much accumulation, but 1/2 inch more snow is possible. And on Sunday, only 20% chance of snow, little accumulation predicted. We do have, however, I love it when we have exciting notices from the National Weather Service. We have a hazardous weather outlook calling for portions of North Idaho and Northeast Washington to be looking out for light to moderate snow expected from this afternoon through Friday for the lower elevations, moderate to locally heavy snow expected in the mountains. Localized pockets of freezing rain tonight. The areas of snow will remain in the forecast through the weekend. Very cool and unsettled weather pattern will settle over the region next week. This will result in temperatures well below normal and a very good chance for moderate to heavy snow. The other alert that we have is an exciting one. It's for avalanches. We are in avalanche warning territory here.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The hazardous weather outlook is for, where is that? Well, anyway, look out for avalanches. I guess that's the warning.
Well, I tell you, you know, Tuesday was a marvelous day, wasn't it? I mean, with what, we woke up and there was something like 7 to 8 inches on the ground. How was it out on Coburn Culver, Brad?
About the same. I started shoveling 8 inches in the morning, 4 in the late morning, and about 4 that evening.
Yeah, I shoveled the driveway 4.5, I mentioned to Brad before we went on the air. The half was the snow berm that the that the city dutifully dumped. But, you know, hey, they've got a job to do. I can't complain. But I tell you, it was powder. It was. You went skiing yesterday. How was it yesterday?
Yesterday was a little bit heavy. It was.
Yes.
I think it would have been better Tuesday. I think the visibility would have been worse, but the snow would have been lighter.
Oh, it was just. And I watched the. I spent a chunk of the day watching the birds, and I had something new at the feeder. I don't think it was feeding the feeder. A Cooper's hawk.
A Cooper's hawk.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't know what it was, but we had a friend visiting from Seattle. He's back there now. But he looked down and he said, "You've got a Cooper's hawk." And let me tell you, I didn't have any other bird around my feeder. Boy, do they know when there's something not very happy that could make their lives.
Sounds like a big bird.
It was bigger than the doves that come to the feeder, and it just sat there and pivoted its head around like, okay, I'm here, I'm ready for whatever.
And is that unusual in this? Do you know anything about it? Are there bird experts listening right now, bird watchers who are jealous of you?
I know Rich Del Carlos, and at least I think he's in Costa Rica, so he can't have bird envy. But I've had hawks in the backyard before, but I haven't seen them. I've seen the results of them, clumps of feathers, and the birds disappear. They disappear for a while. But I guess with all the snow and the access to feed, you know, they came back within about 2-3 hours, and the squirrel popped out, and even the squirrel disappeared. You know, I don't know if a Cooper hawk goes after a squirrel, but boy, did it just. But the bird feeder has been great fun. And before we get too far, I do want to do the weather report from Washington, D.C. area from my sister. We do this every Thursday morning to remind folks that you can stream us. Take us with you. We travel well, don't we, Jack?
We do.
We do.
I'm holding my phone right now. You can get 88.5 KRFY on TuneIn or just from our website, krfy.org.
And right now, the D.C. weather... 38 degrees at 8 a.m., clear and sunny, high of 53 today. And then she provided a commentary, feels like early spring for the day. And let me tell you, D.C. area in the springtime, if you haven't experienced it with the cherry blossoms and all of those beds of daffodils that Lady Bird Johnson planted all over the city, I mean, she didn't go out and plant them one by one herself, but she oversaw. But let me tell you, D.C. is magical in the springtime. And so if it feels like a spring day there, all is well.
I have been to Washington, D.C. one time, but I don't think it was in the spring. I think it was in the summer. Yeah.
But, hey, that's sometimes. Let's talk about our hearts, since this is Valentine's Day, and we are fortunate enough to have Brad back again. He talked about stress before the holidays, and I'm quite sure there's a relationship between stress and one's heart. But how do you make your heart happy, Brad?
I think from you asked me earlier, which patients of mine had the happiest hearts?
Yeah.
And it was those people who had the happiest approach to life. So I have in mind several elderly women who would come in and just be happy, just be laughing pretty much about anything. They just found a way to have a positive outlook on whatever happened to them in life. And as you get older, it's a challenge to maintain that. It's very easy to drop into depression or being a complainer and having that negative energy. But choosing that positive energy just released positive hormones and chemicals within the body and kept their hearts healthy, at least contributed. So I think a lot of it, it's attitude, which is kind of the other side of stress. A lot of our stress comes from our attitude and how we look at things.
Okay. It's curious. Brad is saying one thing, and what I'm hearing, okay, if I have a positive attitude, that means Cheetos and fried chicken. And I take it, a positive attitude alone, but it helps.
Yeah, I guess I'm not following you where you go to the Cheetos from a positive attitude.
Well, you know, I'm figuring, does a positive attitude permit me then to indulge in other things which might not be good for my heart?
That's actually kind of hard to measure. And the only things I want to say for sure are things that can be shown scientifically. Things like smoking is definitely not good for your heart. That's been shown. Definitely increased risk of heart attacks as well as cancers. And that's scientifically proven.
Okay, that's
but
a fact.
Whether having a good attitude will help compensate for having a cheeseburger every day, can't say. however, dietary things do play a significant role in keeping your heart healthy, including lots of vegetables, and interestingly, cocoa.
Cocoa.
What?
Cocoa. Cocoa, in its natural form, is a very bitter substance, which is an extremely powerful antioxidant. And so folks who have a little piece of very dark chocolate, so 80% cocoa or more, so it's very bitter, have a decreased risk of heart attacks.
Interesting. I wouldn't fit into that category because I think milk chocolate is sheer bliss.
I enjoy dark chocolate. It's a perfect day for it. So the chocolate would be an antidote to the rich, fatty meal that I'll be having this week.
The cocoa, not the chocolate, because I bought some of the Hershey's Special Dark and looked up how much cocoa it is, and I think it was like 50%. But you want greater than 80% of cocoa. So it doesn't melt in your mouth. It's a bitter substance, but it has significant health benefits.
Hmm. Is there anything else? Well, okay, when you see antioxidants, the blueberries?
Yes, lots of fruits and vegetables and berries especially have significant antioxidant properties. So pomegranates, blueberries, lots of things that are purple, red.
It's a color thing.
It partly, yeah. Yeah. Mm. So things like kale, purple kale, and dark leafy green vegetables, lettuce. You can get purple lettuce, red lettuce, and those tend to have lots more antioxidants.
Hmm. So I've heard that. I mean, I've heard before the everybody advertises, of course, this product is high in antioxidants. I've heard, you know, drink a glass of red wine for the antioxidants or something like that. What is an antioxidant, and how does that help your heart?
Well, let's back up then to what's called a free radical. And that's not someone from the 60s who was jailed and got free again. Free radicals are substances that come from things in our body where an atom breaks loose or an electron breaks loose and starts damaging tissue. And antioxidants help capture those and prevent that damage from occurring. And so there are substances that help counter some of the natural decay processes that are occurring in our body.
Huh. Well, that's nice.
Yeah.
Well, I'm just thinking, just last week I took out a bag of frozen blueberries that I had picked last summer.
There you go.
And I inhaled them. So as I nibbled on my Cheetos and my cheeseburger and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So there's dietary.
Yes.
Okay. No smoking. Well, not no. We don't want to, you know, say yes or no, but just simply be aware that smoking might not be the best thing for you or your heart.
Let me rephrase that. Smoking is not helpful for you or your heart. From my point of view.
Okay. Okay.
The folks that I saw coming into the emergency room with heart attacks, almost always were smokers.
How about exercise?
Is one of the best things you can do for your heart. It lowers your blood pressure, lowers your stress, can lower your cholesterol, help modify your weight, helps your attitude, it helps prevent depression. And then other things like orthopedic benefits, it can help in older age to prevent falls. And falls are one of the major causes of both getting ill, but also dying in older age. If you fall and break your hip, in many people, that's a death sentence. And so exercise is the best thing you can do. And some of the folks that I saw coming in with heart attacks came in very late in life because they exercised so much. I had I practiced in Colorado, and I had a couple people come in from Mount Snuffles, which was a local peak that was over 14,000 feet. Both had heart attacks on the mountain. One fellow had a very small heart attack, and when we looked at his major arteries, and he had five major branches, two were totally blocked, one was 95% blocked, and one was 90% blocked. And yet he only had a tiny amount of heart damage, primarily because he was such an exerciser that the body formed natural bypasses to supply his heart muscle with blood, even when his major arteries were being blocked.
How does it do that? If your arteries are blocked, then how does it supply in other ways?
It grows new vessels. That lack of oxygen to the cells actually is a chemical stimulation for new blood vessels to grow. And they're tiny. They're not big ones like the normal arteries. Yeah. They're tiny. But if you exercise enough, they are very protective. And so here's a fellow who was out of five vessels living on basically a third of one.
Right.
But he had such natural bypasses that the muscle was protected.
Wow. How long did this process take to occur for him?
Years. It's hard to say, but years and years that these build up over time.
Yeah.
Heart attacks can occur very quickly, and I liken them to having a blackhead in your skin.
Mm-hmm.
That's like the blockage that's inside an artery. And if it just sits there as a blackhead, it doesn't do any problems. It just sits there. It's no big deal. But if it gets inflamed, caused by those free radicals, that inflammation turns it into a pimple. And we've all had those on our skin. They get red and irritated. And then if you squeeze them, they can pop open. When that happens on the inside of the blood vessel, the blood reacts as if there's a hole in the artery. It says, oh my gosh, this is bad. And it plugs it up with a blood clot. That blood clot then continues to build inside the artery and shuts the whole artery down. And so heart attacks can occur very quickly, or blockages can build up over years and years and years. So there's a wide variation in what you can see.
Yeah. Do you feel it? Like, let's say you're having this slow process of having a very slow heart attack. Do you feel like, my blood just isn't circulating right this morning or something like that? Do you start to feel...
That's a hard question to answer. Just blockages building up, you won't feel.
Mm-hmm.
There is such a thing that we call a stuttering heart attack, where a blood clot forms. You feel it. You think, wow, I've got chest discomfort. But then the body dissolves some of the blood clot, and so the heart attack stops, and you feel better. And most people attribute that to indigestion. Oh, I ate something, and it just doesn't. And I've seen people where that's gone on for a month or two, and they finally come in to get checked, and it's like, oh my gosh, you have a very, very bad blockage that we need to open up. Some people do come in with that sense of, something just isn't right. That is very hard to pin down. Sometimes, yes, that can be the heart. Sometimes it can be nerves. Sometimes it can be stomach. Sometimes it can be getting a virus. So that's very hard to pin down when it's so nonspecific like that.
When I think of going back to what Brad was talking about, exercise, I go over to the health club and I try to walk an hour every day or pedal every day. The extra benefit for me is that I don't have a cheeseburger in my one hand while, I know for at least 1/24 of the day I'm not eating. And so that's what I really, as I tell people, I've earned supper now, that you can't eat while, I guess, while exercising like that. And that's an extra bonus.
That's true.
The way I look at it.
Though, if you are prone to eating and snacking, then if you want to stay healthy, have vegetables to eat and snack on.
I knew you'd say that.
If you want to make that work for you and you're just a muncher,
Okay.
You have to make a commitment to drop the Cheetos and the Fritos and the chips and just have green peppers and celery and carrots, and then you can munch on them, and you'll probably be doing yourself a favor rather than hurting yourself.
Okay. I mean, I'm going to wrap my mind around this one snack at a time.
Yeah. I don't know. I've been trying to eat more carrots lately, trying to snack on more carrots because I'm also a snacker.
But I don't mind carrots.
Yeah, it tastes good.
Peppers, I wouldn't mind. I'm not a big pepper fan. So what else about the heart? You, as a cardiologist, what is it like to work on a heart? You know, I mean, as opposed to an ingrown toenail. I mean, this is like really big time, isn't it? I mean, I just cannot imagine the concept of work. Oops, my phone just went off. I'll just turn that off there. What is it like to work? What was it like the first time you worked on a heart, a real life heart in a real life person?
It was really scary. And a lot of that is because of the technical and the manual skills that you need. When you first start, you don't have. And so I was scrubbed in next to the attending physician, the cardiologist, who he was doing the procedure, and I was just learning. I was, you know, handing him the catheters, and I was just assisting. However, I caught on to that pretty quickly, and where I trained, you worked with different doctors each day. And when I did my first angioplasty, I had seen my first one the day before. And an angioplasty is when you had put a catheter up to the heart, put a tiny, tiny wire down the artery through the blockage, and then over that wire slid a very tiny balloon, inflated the balloon, and you inflate it with a liquid solution, not with air. And it stretches open the balloon, and the balloon is a long, narrow one. Like you see clowns make little animals out of.
That's just what I was thinking of.
It's shaped that way. It's not anywhere near that big, rather than a big round balloon. And you inflate the balloon and then deflate it and pull it out. And so I saw one and assisted on one day. And the next day I was with another group and they said, "Have you ever done one of these before?" And I said, "Yep."
"Yep, I'm an old pro."
And so that second day I was starting to do them. And part of that, it just, if you're gifted with manual skills, it's you learn pretty quickly. There are those people who aren't gifted with manual skills and who want to do this, and it's much more difficult for them to learn those things. And it's interesting, when you apply for that training in cardiology or in surgery, they don't do a test of manual skills. I don't know if they do now, but at least when I was in training, they don't. So that work is, when you first start, it's very scary, but it's very technical. Over time, as I got to know my patients better, especially in practice, then it started to become a little more emotional, because then I knew the people.
Have people with the hearts.
You have people rather than just, you know, here's a heart. When I'm doing a heart catheterization and working on a person, the person's entirely covered in drapes.
Yeah.
The camera is up by their head, and so I don't really see them. The nurse is responsible for talking with the patient and making sure they're comfortable and taking care of them. So really all I'm working on is the TV screen. And so it's kind of like a video game.
What was it like before a TV screen, heart surgery, or was there none?
Oh, there was none.
Okay.
The first heart surgery, the first valve implant was in 1952.
Whoa. So we're talking within 60 years?
Yes, really. And the first bypass was only in 1960. And at that point, these were very experimental procedures. They didn't happen very often. And frequently, people died. I lost an uncle when I was in medical school in 1980s during bypass surgery. And And it took quite some time before they became commonplace. Nowadays, over 200,000 bypasses are performed each year. Mm-hmm. And angioplasty, where you put a balloon in, the first one done worldwide was in 1977.
Recent history. Are all hearts the same? I mean, or do you ever go into a person and say, oh, I've never seen that before?
Yeah, and you try to avoid saying oops or wow. People don't like to hear that. You can see the blood pressure go up real quickly. And
I've never seen that before. Come over, everybody, look.
The most common thing that I would see that would be different is that the arteries would be a little bit different than each other. Your standard arteries is you have one main artery on the left side, which branches into two, the anterior descending and the circumflex artery, and then those have branches. And then you have one artery on the right side. About a couple percent of people have a different formation that way, where the two arteries on the left arise from different, not from one main one. They each come off the aorta separately. Sometimes you'll have the main artery on the left coming off the right. And so you only have one main artery, but it's on the right side, and then it cuts across the heart. And those things can be really odd. The thing that was the most remarkable is I had a fellow sent down from another hospital they thought was having a heart attack. And when I went up to put the catheter in his artery, ran it up to his heart, and the way the catheter coursed, it looked like it was in his vein. The main vein of the body, inferior vena cava, goes on the right side of the body, where the aorta goes on the left. And I put the catheter in, and it was on the right side of the body. So I thought, darn, I hit the vein. So I pulled it out, put it in again, same place. And I thought, man, I'm having a bad day. Pulled it out, put it in again, and it was in the same place. I followed it up, and it turned out I was in the artery, in the aorta. He had what's called dextrocardia with situs inversus. And that's where his heart, instead of being on the left side of his body, was on the right side. It was reversed. The heart was reversed. And then situs inversus means all the organs are reversed. The liver, instead of on the right, is on the left. And the spleen is on the right. And so this occurs in about 1 in 10,000 people. And that's why in this person, they weren't sure he was having a heart attack because his EKG looked totally different. Normally on an EKG, the electrodes are put on the left side of the chest. His heart was on the right, so it made it look totally different.
Now, did you know that ahead of time?
No, it was a surprise, and that's why I kept pulling the catheter out, saying I'm in the wrong place. Once I just pushed it up and said, I know I'm in the artery, and saw that the anatomy was different, then I figured out he had this dextrocardia.
So 1 in 10,000 people.
Yeah, and I saw that maybe 2 or 3 times during my practice.
Wow.
Incredible.
It's amazing how that happens.
Well, I mean,
some kind of, you'd think of maybe a mirror in the delivery room or something, and they grab the reflection instead of the baby, or I don't know.
I don't know about you, Jack, but I have a difficult time conceptualizing, you know, Brad is speaking from experience. You know, I shoved it up there and I'm going, how do you do that?
Yeah.
Or, you know, making a balloon, you know, an artery is not a very big thing. And when I think of a balloon, I think of big thing. I'm having a difficult time, having the language. Does that make sense to you, Brad?
It does.
You have the images when you say these things. I don't, and I'm sure Jack doesn't. And we go, whoa.
Well, these balloons, an average size balloon, the diameter would be 2 millimeters. So they're tiny. That's an eighth of an inch.
Wow.
They're very small. And when you put a catheter up, you first put a wire up. And the tip of the wire isn't pointed. The tip of the wire is curved in a J, and it's soft and flexible. So the first thing that goes up is this J.
The curve.
So as it's going through the artery, if it hits any irregularity, it just bounces off. It doesn't poke in.
Wow.
So, yes, there's techniques to make sure that you're not causing more trouble than you're trying to fix.
And you're following a television screen rather than looking down at the heart.
That's correct. All of this is done with X-ray.
Wow.
And so you're looking at a screen.
And that must take a while to, you know, to be looking up here, but you're working down here. You know, the coordination of the eye and hand.
Yes, it's one of those things. Some people get that really quickly, and other people have skills in different areas.
Different areas. Amazing. We're here with retired cardiologist Brad Hutaw, and we're going to take a music break. We're talking about heart, heart issues and how to have a happy heart here on The Morning Show with Jim and Jack. We're going to take a musical break. This is Valentine's Day. Let's do a Roger and Hart song called My Funny Valentine by Chaka Khan from Rufus. This comes from the movie Waiting to Exhale. It was wrapped meal like. Do you trade seats?
That is Chaka Khan. We're back.
We're just we continued our conversation with Brad, Jack. You start first. We just got a lot of directions we can go.
That was Chaka Khan with My Funny Valentine. Rodgers and Hart or Rodgers and Hammerstein?
Rodgers and Hart.
And we're here with retired cardiologist Dr. Brad Hutaw. And I'm sorry, I butchered his last name there, but it's Dr. Brad Hutaw. How do you mend a broken heart, Brad? It's Valentine's Day.
Oh, man.
That's the question.
Strong thread.
Uh-huh. What I had just learned in the first portion of this hour is how recent a lot of these developments were. 1977 was the first angioplasty. That's what you said?
Yeah.
So you, over the course of your career, I mean, your career spanned a majority, I would say, of at least half of like that period of time since these developments were taking place. You've seen almost the beginning of a lot of these operations and technologies, I guess.
Yeah, it was amazing, and I was very fortunate to really be in the golden age of cardiology and of interventions. When I was first an intern in 1985, I remember a fellow in his late 40s came in with a very big heart attack. We put him to bed, and we gave him pain pills, and that's all we did for him. That's all we could do at that time. So even though angioplasty had been first performed in 1977, it had not been proven through scientific studies to be the best treatment. That didn't happen until the late 80s or 90s.
Wow.
Because it takes a long time for these procedures to be developed and perfected. And then you have to do large studies to show that, does this really have a significant benefit, or are we just doing it because it's fun? But in 1985, we put people with heart attacks just to bed. The next year, they started going in with catheters for only certain types of heart attacks, and infusing medicine to dissolve blood clots. So they weren't even doing angioplasty at my hospital at that time. And then by the time I retired, it was routine. Someone comes in with a heart attack, and our goal is to get them to the cath lab as soon as we can. And that was in our hospital about 20 minutes. If I was at home, it took me about 15 minutes to get in, 5 minutes to see the person, and then 10 minutes to get him up to the cath lab and onto the table, another 10 minutes to get all our equipment ready, and then we wanted that balloon across the blockage and opening it up. And the goal nationwide was less than 60 minutes from the time they hit the door of the emergency room to the time you get the balloon inflated and open the artery. And so the standard of care totally changed. It was just phenomenal.
Once that occurred, what are the chances of a success rate if you can do it within an hour?
It depends on, well, your chance of success of opening the artery is probably 99%.
Okay.
However, if someone has waited at home all night with their heart attack and then come in 12 hours into it, they will have had substantial damage.
Damage to their heart.
So there's also the time before they hit the emergency room, and that's probably the critical time because with a totally closed artery in a full-blown heart attack, you have about 4 hours before you have permanent damage to pretty much that whole area of the heart that's being affected. And so you want to get it open, ideally within 4 hours. If you can get it within 1 hour, if someone starts having a heart attack, they immediately call 911 and go to the emergency room. And then you can immediately get the artery open. Then their amount of damage is going to be minimal. Not zero, but minimal, and their prognosis would be much better.
Looks better. I don't know about you, Jack, but just from me, having seen movies and whatever, you know, somebody's walking down the street, go, oh, you know, and then they fall down. You know, that's the way I think of a heart attack, you know, that it's, ah, and you fall down, and people gather around and whisk you off to the hospital. But you're saying that not all heart attacks are like that.
Most are not like that.
Most are, whoa.
Some are. I mean, it can happen that you just go, and then, you know, you clutch your chest and you fall down and that's it.
That's right? termed sudden cardiac arrest.
And okay.
The majority of cases of that are caused by heart attacks, where all of a sudden an artery closes and the heart really doesn't like that. And then what actually happens is the heart muscle, instead of beating in a rhythmic fashion, goes into fibrillation, where it's not pumping blood. And so someone passes out. They're not dead at that point. If that is witnessed and an electrical shock can be applied, then you can restore, in some cases, a normal rhythm. So in cases of sudden cardiac arrest that occur outside the hospital, about 30% of those people make it to the hospital alive, like through AEDs. I'm not sure if how many of those are in Sandpoint, but those are the automatic external defibrillators that are hanging on walls. Someone goes down, you can put them on, and it will automatically diagnose the rhythm and then decide to shock it or not. Or if an ambulance comes and they can shock the rhythm. But about 30% of those people make it to the hospital alive. Only 10% leave the hospital. There's usually that this is a really serious thing. Most people do not do well. But that's about, each year, about 350,000. Heart attacks each year are about 750,000. So most heart attacks occur where either people ignore them and do fine, or they get to the hospital and get treatment.
Yeah.
And if they get to the hospital and get treatment, your risk of dying is less than 5%.
Heaven forbid it should ever happen, but I do always kind of have a fantasy of somebody going down, and then, you know, you pop open the buttons and you rub the paddles together and you go, clear! And then you know, slam. Do you still, I mean, but you don't, do you rub the paddles together still? Does that, if you have an auto defibrillator?
The rubbing the paddles together was you put some conductive gel on one of the paddles, and you're spreading the gel between
like washing your hands.
Yeah, okay. Between both of them. It has nothing to do really with the paddles. You're just spreading the gel. Because if you shock the skin without that,
It'll burn. Sure.
Yeah, and yeah.
Did you ever have, outside of the hospital, were you ever like out, you know, grocery shopping or something where you had to put on your doctor's cap and say, give them air, people, and then, you know, go yeah, in and do something?
I did. I was actually on a trip to Italy. We had just landed. Mm-hmm. We had gone through customs. This was my ex-wife and I, and she was a doctor. And we were waiting for our baggage. And all of a sudden, she and I were talking, and her eyes lit up, and something happened behind me. I turned around, and this fellow had dropped, collapsed. So we both go running over there, And I'm thinking, boy, you know, we have to do CPR. So I ran and to the chest rather than to the head. Because if you're at the head, you have to do mouth to mouth. And I thought, there's no way I'm going to do mouth to mouth on this guy. So I ran to the chest, put my hands and started pumping and looked at my ex-wife. She looked at me and said, I'll go get help, and ran away. So, and fortunately then, an Italian gal ran up, yelled something at me in Italian, and she started doing mouth to mouth. And within a minute, the guy came back.
So this had a happy ending.
Yes, and it turned out he had had a heart attack probably 3 days prior, thought it was his stomach. Mm-hmm. Plus, they had this trip coming up, and so he didn't want to go to the hospital and ruin the trip, and ended up flying over to Italy. And then something else had happened where I think he was on a diuretic medicine, and it ended up causing his potassium level to go very low, which made it much more likely to have an irregular heart rhythm.
Wow. Well, Brad, I'd like to ask you about the heart as part of the body. In terms of, you know, you spent your professional career working with the heart. When you take a step back and look at the heart, and what do you tip your hat off to about a heart? What do you say, wow, you know, in terms of, isn't that an incredible organ, muscle, whatever? I mean, what makes you stand in awe with a heart?
There's many things. The body is such an incredible creation. And I believe in both evolution and creation. I think both happen. It's just such a marvel. But I think the first thing is that so many people are born with normal hearts. The embryological development is so complex that it's a wonder any of us are born normal. And then for those who are born with normal hearts, how well the heart works for so many years. If you think about it, the average heartbeat is 70 beats a minute. In a lifetime, that's about 3 trillion beats. And so think of what's
happening.
So that's a muscle that every second it has to pump, never getting tired, never getting a rest.
And you never feel it.
And it's just doing its job. And then the heart has 4 valves that are opening and closing. And they're enclosed in basically a saltwater environment. The blood, the plasma, is kind of like saltwater. And, you know, you leave something in saltwater for 50 years in the ocean, and it's going to be gone. I mean, it's going to be eroded. And yet, these heart valves can open and close every second for years and years and years and continue to function normally. And it's just phenomenal. It's just phenomenal.
I'm speechless because, you know, you're absolutely correct that unless I sprinted up the stairs or something, and started breathing, I wouldn't know that I have a heart.
Right.
Some people will tell you that I have no heart, but it's incredible that you have this organ that does all of this incredible stuff. Most of the time, you're not even aware of it.
Yes, and that's a bit unfortunate because then we take it for granted.
Amen.
And we think it will always do this, and so we don't take care of it as much as we could, and then that does eventually end up in some people causing deterioration and dysfunction.
I'd like to ask you, you've retired from your career. When you retired, what was the next big, what Jack was saying, all of this within the last, I sort of giggled when you said the golden age of heart, development in terms of treatment and whatever. You know, when I think of golden age, I think of the 30s or the 40s. Here you're talking about recently, what's the next big horizon or the next big step for treatment of the heart?
Several areas come to mind on that. Closest to what I did was the newer generation of stents. Stents were like miniature chain-linked fences wrapped around a balloon so that when you put them in and blew open the balloon, that stent got mashed into the artery, into the walls of the artery, and became a scaffold to keep the artery open. Because normally with just a balloon, you'd stretch open the artery, and then it would stretch back. It would boing back.
Oh, so it's inside the artery, not
Correct.
Outside
it's it. Inside the
inside
artery.
Inside it. Ah.
And the newest generation were bioabsorbable. They would dissolve after 1 to 2 months.
In time, yeah. When rather than it being in there permanently.
Right, right. And so that gave the time for the artery to heal and to repair itself, and then it would no longer need that scaffold. And so that was the closest to what I actually did. Another new thing is they were just doing a trial of putting in new heart valves through a balloon, using a balloon. And this was the aortic valve. And so they would have this valve wrapped around a balloon about the size of your thumb, and put that into the old valve, which was diseased and not working well, open the balloon, and boom, there'd be a new valve in there. It was much more complicated than that. There'd be a huge amount of preoperative evaluation, looking at how much calcium there was and if this was suitable. But it was actually happening, and I was in fairly regular contact with some of the cardiologists at the University of Colorado regarding potential patients for that as I learned about it and learned what they were doing. So that was another thing. A third thing was mechanical artificial hearts, where people whose heart was so weak and were waiting for a heart transplant, they now had implantable hearts where they could put in an artificial heart. And these people, if they responded well to that, could eventually leave the hospital with an artificial heart. And I'm not sure what the current longevity is, but some people had lived over a year with an artificial heart, the whole heart being artificial. And that seemed wild. And then the next thing, which are genetic advances. What kind of genetic things are going to happen to help regrow damaged heart muscles or to grow artificial heart valves in a petri dish from stem cells? So just, you know, kind of science fiction sort of things. But that's going to be very interesting to see what happens over time.
Well, but when you use the words science fiction, I'm quite sure what you, with angioplasty, I'm sure at one time people said, oh, that's science fiction stuff.
When I started my cardiology training, there were still cath labs. I remember hearing one that over the doors to the entrance to the cath lab said, no one with a heart attack shall pass these doors. I mean, it was just, you didn't mess with the heart when it was in the throes of such a traumatic event. And then what we learned is that, no, you go in there and you stop the damage.
Okay, we're coming down to the end of the hour. We could go on. Brad, you know, this is all just fascinating. What haven't we gotten to that you would have liked to have gotten to? I mean, Jack and I are heart amateurs. What would you, the message you would like to get out, or some, we see that you have a piece of paper there. What didn't we get to with about the heart that you would like to have our listeners hear?
I think the main message is, although there's all these miracles, I see them as miracles, science advances of technology that can repair a lot of the damage that we do, the heart has the capability to do so well on its own that we, if we take better care of it, and just from prevention, exercise, eating healthfully, and we talked about those things, but it's easy to get caught up in the gee whiz and the wows of all these miraculous things that we can do. But we'll say, for example, bypass, that's really an incredible thing, but the cost of that is probably over $100,000. And when we look in our society, I know my healthcare premiums go up 10% each year, mm-hmm. and I don't even use my healthcare. And that really annoys me that I'm having to pay for something basically because I'm paying for other people's healthcare because they didn't take care of themselves.
They've made other choices.
And so I think I would really like to see a much greater emphasis in our culture on prevention, on taking care of the gifts that we have been given so that we, one, don't have to pay so much on the back end of things, but two, that we can live better.
Yeah, it's a quality of life issue,
yes.
isn't it?
Yes, it sure is.
You know, when you come down to the bottom line. Jack, how's your heart?
As far as I know, it's okay. But, you know, I mean, there is one thing, like the guy who his organs were flipped and he didn't even know it.
Wow.
It's funny
that's going to stay with me.
Yeah. And I'm thinking of Joe Strummer from The Clash. There was, I can't remember the name of it. I should have looked it up. But he had some defect in his heart. That's what he died of. He died at a relatively young age, 50
Absolutely.
Or something like that. And it could have just happened at any time. There was some defect that he was born with. He had it all his life.
And it was unaware.
And he was never aware of it. And then suddenly just boom. I mean, it's strange to think about. And is it, I don't know. I guess we never know. Do you think, Brad, that we'll ever get to a place where you can just go into something like an MRI or some kind of machine where you can just full checkout, just scan for everything? What's wrong with this person?
We have that capability now. Those tests do exist that everyone could get checked. What the limiting thing is cost.
Cost. Mm-hmm.
For example, with athletes, there's a condition called hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. And when you hear of an athlete running down the court and then dropping dead, this is what they have. That condition is easily diagnosed by having an echocardiogram or an ultrasound of the heart. But to do a ultrasound of every athlete in the United States is prohibited because of the cost issues. If we could get rid of that, then that capability is available to look at non-invasively the muscles, the valves, the great vessels, the coronary arteries, the function of the heart. You can do that now.
I've got something in the back of my mind is working at this time of year, and you might not have the answer for it, but every so often you hear about someone who falls through the ice, usually a child or something like that, and they pull the child out 3-4 minutes later. Does the heart slow down?
Yes.
Okay, and what's going on there? Because, you know, this is another part of the heart, you know, that I'm not totally understanding.
The diving reflex is when you go underwater like that, especially in the cold.
Yeah.
Everything slows down. We actually started using that in patients who had a cardiac arrest outside the hospital.
Okay.
Were brought back to the hospital alive, though usually unconscious. Mm-hmm. We would put them into hypothermia. We would wrap them in ice, and we would want to cool them down and make them cold in order to help the body deal with the trauma they've been through. Also being underwater like that, everything slowed down. And that's why many of those children, if that happens, can recover neurologically intact. We would use those same things for survivors of cardiac arrest in the first 24 hours to help prevent as much brain damage as normally would have occurred.
So does the heart of the child that has slowed down, does it return then, if the child survives the experience, return to a normal capacity, normal functioning?
It can, yes, it can. Now, you can't say it always does,
but
but it can.
That's just amazing. We've been here this past hour on Valentine's Day with Brad Hutaw, retired cardiologist, sharing a lot of incredible information about the heart. And whether you're aware of it or not, be friendly to it and treat it with attention and care, and it will serve you quality-wise for quite a while.
And vegetables.
Well, you know what you were talking about, you know what I've been thinking? Why don't they make, like, kale in the shape of potato chips and Cheetos?
I think that they do. Kale, there is such a thing as kale chips now.
Okay.
It's coming out. It's
coming
along.
I know they have banana chips, and I like banana chips because you just say chips. You know, it's like a dog with squirrel.
Yeah.
Squirrel. You know, like that. You say chips.
Okay. That's our heart out,
that,
I think.
No, no, that's our heart. Without that top of the hour, I mean, that goes on without us noticing. Brad, thank you so much for coming in.
You're welcome.
We really appreciate, once again, your sharing your knowledge and your skill set. And we want to wish everyone, we had a couple more Valentine songs. Are we going to shove it over the next hour?
Yeah, we'll start off the next hour with Willie Nelson's Valentine.
And then, of course, Heart, Anne and Nancy Wilson. How can one not do Valentine's Day without Heart? And we're going to do What About Love?
Yeah. That play that we interviewed them for, Drinking Habits, is
tonight at the Panda Theater. It's tonight, Friday, Saturday. I think they're all at 7 o'clock, and Sunday is a matinee at 3:30. If you want tickets or more information, go to panada.org. Support live theater here in the community.
And also, it's the Winter Carnival starting this weekend. Friday night is the Parade of Lights downtown.
And I want to wish you a very happy Valentine's Day.
Oh, thanks, Jim.
And in 2 weeks, I'll be back.
Thank goodness. And my heart will be on the mend.
And we're going to miss you next week. I'm going to leave my heart in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm. We're going to go to Bird Note now and then Otto's Eclectic Mix all day long here on 88.5 KRFY Ponderay.